to Disney's magic shop, where he learned tricks from the older employees. He experimented with jokes and tried out simple routines on visitors. Soon he discovered that what he loved was not performing magic, but performing in general. He set his sights on becoming a comedian. Beginning in his teenage years, he started performing in little clubs around Los Angeles. The crowds were small, and his act was short. He was rarely on stage for more than 5 minutes. Most of the people in the crowd were too busy drinking or talking with friends to pay attention. One night, he literally delivered his stand-up routine to an empty club. It wasn't glamorous work, but there was no doubt he was getting better. His first routines would only last 1 or 2 minutes. By high school, his material had expanded into a 5-minute act, and a few years later, a 10-minute show. At 19, he was performing weekly for 20 minutes at a time. He had to read 3 poems during the show just to make the routine long enough, but his skills continued to progress. He spent another decade experimenting, adjusting, and practicing. He took a job as a television writer, and gradually, he was able to land his own appearances on talk shows. By the mid-1970s, he had worked his way into being a regular guest on The Tonight Show and Saturday Night Live. Finally, after 15 years of work, the young man rose to fame. He toured 60 cities in 63 days, then 72 cities in 80 days, then 85 cities in 90 days. He had 18,695 people attend one show in Ohio. Another 45,000 tickets were sold for his 3-day show in New York. He catapulted to the top of his genre and became one of the most successful comedians of his time. His name is Steve Martin. Martin's story offers a fascinating perspective on what it takes to stick with habits for the long run. Comedy is not for the timid. It is hard to imagine a situation that would strike fear into the hearts of more people than performing alone on stage and failing to get a single laugh. And yet, Steve Martin faced this fear every week for 18 years. In his words, 10 years spent learning, 4 years spent refining, and 4 years as a wild success. Why is it that some people, like Martin, stick with their habits, whether practicing jokes or drawing cartoons or playing guitar, while most of us struggle to stay motivated? How do we design habits that pull us in rather than ones that fade away? Scientists have been studying this question for many years. While there is still much to learn, one of the most consistent findings is that the way to maintain motivation and achieve peak levels of desire is to work on tasks of just manageable difficulty. The human brain loves a challenge, but only if it is within an optimal zone of difficulty. If you love tennis and try to play a serious match against a 4-year-old, you will quickly become bored. It's too easy. You'll win every point. In contrast, if you play a professional tennis player like Roger Federer or Serena Williams, you will quickly lose motivation because the match is too difficult. Now, consider playing tennis against someone who is your equal. As the game progresses, you win a few points and you lose a few. You have a good chance of winning, but only if you really try. Your focus narrows, distractions fade away, and you find yourself fully invested in the task at hand. This is a challenge of just manageable difficulty, and it is a prime example of the Goldilocks rule. The Goldilocks rule states that humans experience peak motivation when working on tasks that are right on the edge of their current abilities. Not too hard, not too easy, just right. Martin's comedy career is an excellent example of the Goldilocks rule in practice. Each year, he expanded his comedy routine, but only by a minute or two. He was always adding new material, but he also kept a few jokes that were guaranteed to get laughs. There were just enough victories to keep him motivated, and just enough mistakes to keep him working hard. When you're starting a new habit, it's important to keep the behavior as easy as possible so you can stick with it even when the conditions aren't perfect. This is an idea we covered in detail while discussing the third law of behavior change. Once a habit has been established, however, it's important to continue to advance in small ways. These little improvements and new challenges keep you engaged, and if you hit the Goldilocks zone just right, you can achieve a flow state. A flow state is the experience of being in the zone and fully immersed in an activity. Scientists have tried to quantify this feeling. They found that to achieve a state of flow, a task must be roughly 4% beyond your current ability. In real life, it's typically not feasible to quantify the difficulty of an action in this way, but the core idea of the Goldilocks rule remains. Working on challenges of just manageable difficulty, something on the perimeter of your ability, seems crucial for maintaining motivation. Improvement requires a delicate balance. You need to regularly search for challenges that push you to your edge while continuing to make enough progress to stay motivated. Behaviors need to remain novel in order for them to stay attractive and satisfying. Without variety, we get bored. And boredom is perhaps the greatest villain on the quest for self-improvement. How to stay focused when you get bored working on your goals. After my baseball career ended, I was looking for a new sport. I joined a weightlifting team, and one day, an elite coach visited our gym. He had worked with thousands of athletes during his long career, including a few Olympians. I introduced myself, and we began talking about the process of improvement. "What's the difference between the best athletes and everyone else?" I asked. "What do the really successful people do that most don't?" He mentioned the factors you might expect: genetics, luck, talent. But then he said something I wasn't expecting. "At some point, it comes down to who can handle the boredom of training every day, doing the same lifts over and over and over." His answer surprised me because it's a different way of thinking about work ethic. People talk about getting amped up to work on their goals. Whether it's business or sports or art, you hear people say things like, "It all comes down to passion," or "You have to really want it." As a result, many of us get depressed when we lose focus or motivation because we think that successful people have some bottomless reserve of passion. But this coach was saying that really successful people feel the same lack of motivation as everyone else. The difference is that they still find a way to show up despite the feelings of boredom. Mastery requires practice, but the more you practice something, the more boring and routine it becomes. Once the beginner gains have been made, and we learn what to expect, our interest starts to fade. Sometimes it happens even faster than that. All you have to do is hit the gym a few days in a row, or publish a couple of blog posts on time, and letting one day slip doesn't feel like much. Things are going well. It's easy to rationalize taking a day off because you're in a good place. The greatest threat to success is not failure, but boredom. We get bored with habits because they stop delighting us. The outcome becomes expected. And as our habits become ordinary, we start derailing our progress to seek novelty. Perhaps this is why we get caught up in a never-ending cycle, jumping from one workout to the next, one diet to the next, one business idea to the next. As soon as we experience the slightest dip in motivation, we begin seeking a new strategy, even if the old one was still working. As Machiavelli noted, "Men desire novelty to such an extent that those who are doing well wish for a change as much as those who are doing badly." Perhaps this is why many of the most habit-forming products are those that provide continuous forms of novelty. Video games provide visual novelty, porn provides sexual novelty, junk foods provide culinary novelty. Each of these experiences offer continual elements of surprise. In psychology, this is known as a variable reward. Slot machines are the most common real-world example. A gambler hits the jackpot every now and then, but not at any predictable interval. The pace of the reward varies. This variance leads to the greatest spike of dopamine, enhances memory recall, and accelerates habit formation. Variable rewards won't create a craving. That is, you can't take a reward someone is uninterested in, give it to them at a variable interval, and hope it will change their mind. But they are a powerful way to amplify the cravings we already experience because they reduce boredom. The sweet spot of desire occurs at a 50-50 split between success and failure. Half of the time you get what you want, half of the time you don't. You need just enough winning to experience satisfaction and just enough wanting to experience desire. This is one of the benefits of following the Goldilocks rule. If you're already interested in a habit, working on challenges of just manageable difficulty is a good way to keep things interesting. Of course, not all habits have a variable reward component, and you wouldn't want them to. If Google only delivered a useful search result some of the time, I would switch to a competitor pretty quickly. If Uber only picked up half of my trips, I doubt I'd use the service much longer. And if I flossed my teeth each night, but only sometimes ended up with a clean mouth, I think I'd skip it. Variable rewards or not, no habit will stay interesting forever. At some point, everyone faces the same challenge on the journey of self-improvement. You have to fall in love with boredom. We all have goals that we would like to achieve and dreams that we would like to fulfill. But it doesn't matter what you are trying to become better at. If you only do the work when it's convenient or exciting, then you'll never be consistent enough to achieve remarkable results. I can guarantee that if you manage to start a habit and keep sticking to it, there will be days when you feel like quitting. When you start a business, there will be days when you don't feel like showing up. When you're at the gym, there will be sets that you don't feel like finishing. When it's time to write, there will be days when you don't feel like typing. But stepping up when it's annoying or painful or draining or boring, That's what makes the difference between a professional and an amateur. Professionals stick to the schedule. Amateurs let life get in the way. Professionals know what is important to them and work toward it with purpose. Amateurs get pulled off course by the urgencies of life. David Kane, an author and meditation teacher, encourages his students to avoid being fair-weather meditators. Similarly, you don't want to be a fair-weather athlete or a fair-weather writer or a fair-weather anything. When a habit is truly important to you, you have to be willing to stick with it in any mood. Professionals take action even when the mood isn't right. They might not enjoy it, but they find a way to put the reps in. There have been a lot of sets I haven't felt like finishing, but I've never regretted doing the workout. There have been a lot of articles I haven't felt like writing, but I've never regretted publishing on schedule. There have been a lot of days I felt like relaxing, but I've never regretted showing up and working on something that was important to me. The only way to become excellent is to be endlessly fascinated by doing the same thing over and over. You have to fall in love with boredom. Chapter summary. The Goldilocks rule states that humans experience peak motivation when working on tasks that are right on the edge of their current abilities. The greatest threat to success is not failure, but boredom. As habits become routine, they become less interesting and less satisfying. We get bored. Anyone can work hard when they feel motivated. It's the ability to keep going when work isn't exciting that makes the difference. Professionals stick to the schedule. Amateurs let life get in the way. Chapter 20. The Downside of Creating Good Habits. Habits create the foundation for mastery. In chess, it is only after the basic movements of the pieces have become automatic that a player can focus on the next level of the game. Each chunk of information that is memorized opens up the mental space for more effortful thinking. This is true for any endeavor. When you know the simple movements so well that you can perform them without thinking, you are free to pay attention to more advanced details. In this way, habits are the backbone of any pursuit of excellence. However, the benefits of habits come at a cost. At first, each repetition develops fluency, speed, and skill. But then, as a habit becomes automatic, you become less sensitive to feedback. You fall into mindless repetition. It becomes easier to let mistakes slide. When you can do it good enough on autopilot, you stop thinking about how to do it better. The upside of habits is that we can do things without thinking. The downside of habits is that you get used to doing things a certain way and stop paying attention to little errors. You assume you're getting better because you're gaining experience. In reality, you are merely reinforcing your current habits, not improving them. In fact, some research has shown that once a skill has been mastered, there is usually a slight decline in performance. Usually, this minor dip in performance is no cause for worry. You don't need a system to continuously improve how well you brush your teeth or tie your shoes or make your morning cup of tea. With habits like these, good enough is usually good enough. The less energy you spend on trivial choices, the more you can spend it on what really matters. However, when you want to maximize your potential and achieve elite levels of performance, you need a more nuanced approach. You can't repeat the same things blindly and expect to become exceptional. Habits are necessary, but not sufficient for mastery. What you need is a combination of automatic habits and deliberate practice. Habits plus deliberate practice equal mastery. To become great, certain skills do need to become automatic. Basketball players need to be able to dribble without thinking before they can move on to mastering layups with their non-dominant hand. Surgeons need to repeat the first incision so many times that they could do it with their eyes closed, so they can focus on the hundreds of other variables that arise during surgery. But after one habit has been mastered, you have to return to the effortful part of the work and begin building the next habit. Mastery is the process of narrowing your focus to a tiny element of success, repeating it until you have internalized the skill, and then using this new habit as the foundation to advance to the next frontier of your development. Old tasks become easier the second time around, but it doesn't get any easier overall, because now you're pouring your energy into the next challenge. Each habit unlocks the next level of performance. It is an endless cycle. Although habits are powerful, what you need is a way to remain conscious of your performance over time, so you can continue to refine and improve. It is precisely at the moment when you begin to feel like you have mastered a skill, right when things are starting to feel automatic and you are becoming comfortable, that you must avoid slipping into the trap of complacency. The solution? Establish a system for reflection and review. How to review your habits and make adjustments. In 1986, the Los Angeles Lakers had one of the most talented basketball teams ever assembled, but they are rarely remembered that way. The team started the 1985-1986 NBA season with an astounding 29-5 record. The pundits were saying that we might be the best team in the history of basketball, head coach Pat Riley said after the season. Surprisingly, the Lakers stumbled in the 1986 playoffs and suffered a season-ending defeat in the Western Conference Finals. The best team in the history of basketball didn't even play for the NBA championship. After that blow, Riley was tired of hearing about how much talent his players had and about how much promise his team held. He didn't want to see flashes of brilliance followed by a gradual fade in performance. He wanted the Lakers to play up to their potential, night after night. In the summer of 1986, he created a plan to do exactly that, a system that he called the Career Best Effort Program, or CBE. When players first joined the Lakers, Riley explained, we track their basketball statistics all the way back to high school. I call this taking their number. We look for an accurate gauge of what a player can do, then build him into our plan for the team based on the notion that he will maintain and then improve upon his averages. After determining a player's baseline level of performance, Riley added a key step. He asked each player to improve their output by at least 1% over the course of the season. If they succeeded, it would be a CBE, or career best effort. Similar to the British cycling team that we discussed in Chapter 1, the Lakers sought peak performance by getting slightly better each day. Riley was careful to point out that CBE was not merely about points or statistics, but about giving your best effort spiritually, mentally, and physically. Players got credit for allowing an opponent to run into you when you know that a foul will be called against him, diving for loose balls, going after rebounds whether you are likely to get them or not, helping a teammate when the player he's guarding has surged past him, and other unsung hero deeds. The CBE number was calculated for all of a player's games, and it was the average CBE that a player was asked to improve by 1% over the season. Riley compared each player's current CBE to not only their past performances, but also those of other players in the league. As Riley put it, we rank team members alongside league opponents who played the same position and have similar role definitions. Sports writer Jackie McMullen noted, Riley trumpeted the top performers in the league in bold lettering on the blackboard each week and measured them against the corresponding players on his own roster. Solid, reliable players generally rated a score in the 600s, while elite players scored at least 800. Magic Johnson, who submitted 138 triple-doubles in his career, often scored over 1,000. The Lakers also emphasized year-over-year progress by making historical comparisons of CBE data. Riley said, we stacked the month of November 1986 next to November 1985 and showed the players whether they were doing better or worse than at the same point last season. Then, we showed them how their performance figures for December 1986 stacked up against November's. The Lakers rolled out the CBE program in October 1986. 8 months later, they were NBA champions. The following year, Pat Riley led his team to another title as the Lakers became the first team in 20 years to win back-to-back NBA championships. Afterward, he said, sustaining an effort is the most important thing for any enterprise. The way to be successful is to learn how to do things right, then do them the same way every time. The CBE program is a prime example of the power of reflection and review. The Lakers were already talented. CBE helped them get the most out of what they had and made sure their habits improved rather than declined. Reflection and review enables the long-term improvement of all habits because it makes you aware of your mistakes and helps you consider possible paths for improvement. Without reflection, we can make excuses, create rationalizations, and lie to ourselves. We have no process for determining whether we are performing better or worse compared to yesterday. Top performers in all fields engage in various types of reflection and review, and the process doesn't have to be complex. Kenyan runner Eliud Kipchoge is one of the greatest marathon runners of all time and an Olympic gold medalist. He still takes notes after every practice in which he reviews his training for the day and searches for areas that can be improved. Similarly, gold medal swimmer Katie Ledecky records her wellness on a scale of 1 to 10 and includes notes on her nutrition and how well she slept. She also records the times posted by other swimmers. At the end of each week, her coach goes over her notes and adds his thoughts. It's not just athletes either. When comedian Chris Rock is preparing fresh material, he will first appear at small nightclubs dozens of times and test hundreds of jokes. He brings a notepad on stage and records which bits go over well and where he needs to make adjustments. The few killer lines that survive will form the backbone of his new show. I know of executives and investors who keep a decision journal in which they record the major decisions they make each week, why they made them, and what they expect the outcome to be. They review their choices at the end of each month or year to see where they were correct and where they went wrong. If you're interested in keeping your own decision journal, I created a template for doing so. You can find it included as part of the Habit Journal, available at atomichabits.com/journal. Improvement is not just about learning habits, it's also about fine-tuning them. Reflection and review ensures that you spend your time on the right things and make course corrections whenever necessary, like Pat Riley adjusting the effort of his players on a nightly basis. You don't want to keep practicing a habit if it becomes ineffective. Personally, I employ two modes of reflection and review. Each December, I perform an annual review in which I reflect on the previous year. I tally my habits for the year by counting up how many articles I published, how many workouts I put in, how many new places I visited, and more. You can see my previous annual reviews at jamesclear.com/annual-review. Finally, I reflect on my progress, or lack thereof, by answering three questions. 1. What went well this year? 2. What didn't go so well this year? 3. What did I learn? 6 months later, when summer rolls around, I conduct an integrity report. Like everyone, I make a lot of mistakes. My integrity report helps me realize where I went wrong and motivates me to get back on course. I use it as a time to revisit my core values and consider whether I have been living in accordance with them. This is when I reflect on my identity and how I can work toward being the type of person I wish to become. You can see my previous integrity reports at jamesclear.com/integrity. My yearly integrity report answers three questions. 1. What are the core values that drive my life and work? 2. How am I living and working with integrity right now? 3. How can I set a higher standard in the future? These two reports, the annual review and the integrity report, don't take very long. It's just a few hours a year. But they are crucial periods of refinement. They prevent the gradual slide that happens when I don't pay close attention. They provide an annual reminder to revisit my desired identity and consider how my habits are helping me become the type of person I wish to be. They indicate when I should upgrade my habits and take on new challenges, and when I should dial my efforts back and focus on the fundamentals. Reflection can also bring a sense of perspective. Daily habits are powerful because of how they compound, but worrying too much about every daily choice is like looking at yourself in the mirror from an inch away. You can see every imperfection and lose sight of the bigger picture. There is too much feedback. Conversely, never reviewing your habits is like never looking in the mirror. You aren't aware of easily fixable flaws, a spot on your shirt, a bit of food in your teeth. There is too little feedback. But periodic reflection and review is like viewing yourself in the mirror from a conversational distance. You can see the important changes you should make without losing sight of the bigger picture. You want to view the entire mountain range, not obsess over each peak and valley. Finally, reflection and review offers an ideal time to revisit one of the most important aspects of behavior change, identity. How to break the beliefs that hold you back. In the beginning, repeating a habit is essential to build up evidence of your desired identity. As you latch on to that new identity, however, those same beliefs can hold you back from the next level of growth. When working against you, your identity creates a kind of pride that encourages you to deny your weak spots and prevents you from truly growing. This is one of the greatest downsides of building habits. The more sacred an idea is to us, that is, the more deeply it is tied to our identity, the more strongly we will defend it against criticism. You see this in every industry. The school teacher, who ignores innovative teaching methods and sticks with her tried and true lesson plans. The veteran manager, who is committed to doing things his way. The surgeon, who dismisses the ideas of her younger colleagues. The band, who produces a mind-blowing first album and then gets stuck in a rut. The tighter we cling to an identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it. One solution is to avoid making any single aspect of your identity an overwhelming portion of who you are. In the words of investor Paul Graham, keep your identity small. The more you let a single belief define you, the less capable you are of adapting when life challenges you. If you tie up everything in being the point guard or the partner at the firm or whatever else, then the loss of that facet of your life will wreck you. If you're a vegan and then develop a health condition that forces you to change your diet, you'll have an identity crisis on your hands. When you cling too tightly to one identity, you become brittle. Lose that one thing, and you lose yourself. For most of my young life, being an athlete was a major part of my identity. After my baseball career ended, I struggled to find myself. When you spend your whole life defining yourself in one way, and that disappears, who are you now? Military veterans and former entrepreneurs report similar feelings. If your identity is wrapped up in a belief like, "I'm a great soldier," what happens after your period of service ends? For many business owners, their identity is something along the lines of, "I'm the CEO," or "I'm the founder." If you have spent every waking moment working on your business, how will you feel after you sell the company? The key to mitigating these losses of identity is to redefine yourself such that you get to keep important aspects of your identity even if your particular role changes. So, "I am an athlete" becomes, "I'm the type of person who is mentally tough and loves a physical challenge." Or, "I'm a great soldier" transforms into, "I'm the type of person who is disciplined, reliable, and great on a team." "I'm the CEO" translates to, "I'm the type of person who builds and creates things." When chosen effectively, an identity can be flexible rather than brittle. Like water flowing around an obstacle, your identity works with the changing circumstances rather than against them. The following quote from the Tao Te Ching encapsulates these ideas perfectly. "Men are born soft and supple. Dead, they are stiff and hard. Plants are born tender and pliant. Dead, they are brittle and dry. Thus, whoever is stiff and inflexible is a disciple of death. Whoever is soft and yielding is a disciple of life. The hard and the stiff will be broken. The soft and the supple will prevail." Lao Tzu. Habits deliver numerous benefits, but the downside is that they can lock us into our previous patterns of thinking and acting, even when the world is shifting around us. Everything is impermanent. Life is constantly changing, so you need to periodically check in to see if your old habits and beliefs are still serving you. A lack of self-awareness is poison. Reflection and review is the antidote. Chapter summary. The upside of habits is that we can do things without thinking. The downside is that we stop paying attention to little errors. Habits plus deliberate practice equal mastery. Reflection and review is a process that allows you to remain conscious of your performance over time. The tighter we cling to an identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it. Conclusion. The secret to results that last. There is an ancient Greek parable known as the Sorites Paradox, which talks about the effect one small action can have when repeated enough times. One formulation of the paradox goes as follows. Can one coin make a person rich? If you give a person a pile of 10 coins, you wouldn't claim that he or she is rich. But what if you add another, and another, and another? At some point, you will have to admit that no one can be rich unless one coin can make him or her so. We can say the same about atomic habits. Can one tiny change transform your life? It is unlikely that you would say so. But what if you made another, and another, and another? At some point, you will have to admit that your life was transformed by one small change. The holy grail of habit change is not a single 1% improvement, but 1,000 of them. It's a bunch of atomic habits stacking up, each one a fundamental unit of the overall system. In the beginning, small improvements can often seem meaningless because they get washed away by the weight of the system. Just as one coin won't make you rich, one positive change, like meditating for 1 minute or reading one page each day, is unlikely to deliver a noticeable difference. Gradually, though, as you continue to layer small changes on top of one another, the scales of life start to move. Each improvement is like adding a grain of sand to the positive side of the scale, slowly tilting things in your favor. Eventually, if you stick with it, you hit a tipping point. Suddenly, it feels easier to stick with good habits. The weight of the system is working for you rather than against you. Over the course of this book, we've looked at dozens of stories about top performers. We've heard about Olympic gold medalists, award-winning artists, business leaders, life-saving physicians, and star comedians who have all used the science of small habits to master their craft and vault to the top of their fields. Each of the people, teams, and companies we have covered has faced different circumstances, but ultimately progressed in the same way, through a commitment to tiny, sustainable, unrelenting improvements. Success is not a goal to reach or a finish line to cross. It is a system to improve, an endless process to refine. In chapter 1, I said, if you're having trouble changing your habits, the problem isn't you. The problem is your system. Bad habits repeat themselves again and again, not because you don't want to change, but because you have the wrong system for change. As this book draws to a close, I hope the opposite is true. With the 4 laws of behavior change, you have a set of tools and strategies that you can use to build better systems and shape better habits. Sometimes a habit will be hard to remember, and you'll need to make it obvious. Other times, you won't feel like starting, and you'll need to make it attractive. In many cases, you may find that a habit will be too difficult, and you'll need to make it easy. And sometimes, you won't feel like sticking with it, and you'll need to make it satisfying. This is a continuous process. There is no finish line. There is no permanent solution. Whenever you're looking to improve, you can rotate through the 4 laws of behavior change until you find the next bottleneck. Make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, make it satisfying. Round and round, always looking for the next way to get 1% better. The secret to getting results that last is to never stop making improvements. It's remarkable what you can build if you just don't stop. It's remarkable the business you can build if you don't stop working. It's remarkable the body you can build if you don't stop training. It's remarkable the knowledge you can build if you don't stop learning. It's remarkable the fortune you can build if you don't stop saving. It's remarkable the friendships you can build if you don't stop caring. Small habits don't add up. They compound. That's the power of atomic habits. Tiny changes, remarkable results. Appendix and additional resources. What should you listen to next? Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this book. It has been a pleasure sharing my work with you. If you're looking for something to listen to or read next, allow me to offer a suggestion. If you enjoyed Atomic Habits, then you may like my other writing as well. My latest articles are sent out in my free weekly newsletter. Subscribers are also the first to hear about my newest books and projects. Finally, in addition to my own work, each year I send out a reading list of my favorite books from other authors on a wide range of subjects. You can sign up at atomichabits.com/newsletter. How to apply these ideas to business. Over the years, I've spoken at Fortune 500 companies and growing startups about how to apply the science of small habits to run more effective businesses and build better products. I've compiled many of the most practical strategies into a short bonus chapter. I think you'll find it to be an incredibly useful addition to the main ideas mentioned in Atomic Habits. You can download this chapter at atomichabits.com/business. How to apply these ideas to parenting. One of the most common questions I hear from listeners is something along the lines of, how can I get my kids to do this stuff? The ideas in Atomic Habits are intended to apply broadly to all of human behavior. Teenagers are humans too, which means you should find plenty of useful strategies in the main text. That said, parenting does face its own set of challenges. As a bonus chapter, I've put together a brief guide on how to apply these ideas specifically to parenting. You can download this chapter at atomichabits.com/parenting. This is James Clear. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Atomic Habits, an easy and proven way to build good habits and break bad ones. Tiny changes, remarkable results. This program was produced by Robert Kessler, executive producer Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by James Clear. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.